I'm Sharmila Rudrappa, and I'm an assistant professor in sociology here at the University of Texas at Austin in sociology and in Asian American studies. I just finished 4 years of being in Austin. I graduated from Madison, Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin at Madison, where I spent a large amount of time being in graduate school. It was a bit difficult to leave the town. I came to the United States in 1989 as a graduate student in environmental studies and got my master's in that and switched to sociology for a PhD. Completed my degree in 2000 and got this job and moved here to Austin, Texas. Presently, I am on an H-1B. Most of my student life here in the U.S., I was on F-1 visa, which is my student status. And the minute I got this job here at UT, University of Texas, they changed it to an H-1B visa, which is a temporary worker visa, meaning this visa is valid for 3 years. And then earlier this year, I applied for an extension for
context and abuses.
Okay. The H-1B as a visa category was started in 1990. Basically, what the U.S. government feels right around this time prior to this law being passed is that they're not getting in enough skilled workers. And so to bring in skilled workers, they have this visa category called H-1B, which is going to bring in skilled workers into the U.S. to help, to help at some level build the economy because you need more and more skilled workers. So initially the cap was at bringing in 65,000 workers annually. And this changes in 1998, but we'll talk about that later. Basically what the H-1B is that you have certain technical skills or certain kinds of education qualifications that will qualify you for getting a high-tech job or in a company at a higher level based on your education qualifications. So however, the conversion from an H-1B into permanent residency depends on the company that they're working for.
So on the what?
On the company they're working for. So the company then has to sponsor their papers. This is where the abuse can start happening.
Okay, so
what the H-1B does is say, Ginger, you're my employer and you sponsor my H-1B. That is, I'm a student in the U.S., you want me to be your employee, and so you will actually file papers for me to be an H-1B temporary worker in your company. Now, if I want to leave your company because another company is going to pay me better wages, I have more opportunities for growth in another company, I am unable to switch unless the other company sponsors my H-1B. So basically what the H-1B does is it ties these individuals, these high-skilled workers, very effectively to the single company that they're working for. And also there's the promise of the green card coming down the road, which might be 3 years down the road, which might be 6 years down the road. So a lot of individuals are very reluctant to leave the company they're working for because there's this carrot hanging there. That is the green card. So they might be willing to take lower wages. They might be willing to work longer hours. They might be actually much more exploitable than our citizen workers. And this is where you start seeing the abuse of the H-1B system happening. Exploit my workers.
Right.
Now, say I own a company that basically runs as a body shop.
Or another word would be temp agency or consultant or...
I guess a consulting company is what we could call it, rather than... It sort of acts like a temp agency, but it's slightly different. Now, as a consulting company, I might have a whole bunch of workers who are on H-1Bs, very skilled individuals, very well-trained individuals. So what I would do is I would look for different companies that I would consult for, that would give me contracts for which I would do, my company would do work for them. So what I would then do is I would send my workforce to go do that job for maybe 2 months, maybe 3 months, finish that project, and bring my workers back. For that, I would get a lump sum of money that is contracted to me from that company that I've just worked for. But the kinds of pay that I give to the workers who've actually done the dog work of running that contract, I would pay them pitiful amounts of money. The remuneration is very, very low. The other thing that's been happening with body shops is that is one way by which workers get horribly exploited. Now, the other way by which workers can get exploited is that if there is no contract work for my company to do, I bench the workers, meaning they don't really come for work and they don't get any pay.
So they are in this country.
They're in this country and they're not receiving pay. So for one, a lot of middle-class Indians value education very highly. Throughout the 70s and 80s, there's been this emphasis on technical training because that was where, you know, to become a professional. So there's huge numbers of men and women who entered engineering schools. Now, the second
in
thing...
In India.
If you go into programs like architecture, for example, you would easily see maybe 50% women, 50% men. I mean, very, very strong numbers of women in engineering fields, at least when I was growing up in the 80s. And also, there's been a proliferation of software programming institutions, two-year institutions, three-year colleges, that basically teach young adults software programming. Actually try to figure out with this research was why is it that these individuals are going back to India? If they're American citizens, if everything is going well for them here, they have these great homes, they have these great paychecks, and why this desire to go back to India? One of the things I wanted to find out was whether 9/11 had an effect, mainly because we started seeing a large amount of racism and backlash against people who looked Arab, and there was quite a bit of violence against South Asian Americans. So I wanted to see whether that was affecting people. And the other thing I wanted to see was whether the dot-com crash also affected why these individuals were going back. It didn't seem that was the case for those individuals who were able to become American citizens. Now, there was another group of Indians who came as perhaps to work in the U.S. They came directly on H-1Bs from India because companies here sponsored them. Many of these individuals were not able to convert their H-1B status into permanent residency. And so when they lost their jobs, they had to leave the U.S. So they'd made all of these incredible sacrifices in coming to the U.S., had these amazing hopes, dreams, and desires of making it here, but none of that transpired. And they need
the influence of that.
Let me talk a bit about 9/11. Mainly what happened is with 9/11 happening, a lot of Indians were mistaken to be Arabs or thought to be Muslims and therefore a national threat. Not by the State Department, not by the US government, but by various Americans on the street. So you would see a lot of racial slurs being thrown at South Asian Americans, hate crimes, even individuals who were killed in gas stations and places like that. And so a lot of the individuals I interviewed actually spoke about the fear that they felt in going back and forth to work and coming back home, going grocery shopping. So they felt quite a bit of fear, but it doesn't seem to have affected those H-1Bs coming into the U.S. necessarily.
They've responded to your request to talk.
Now, most of the H-1B individuals, like me, who are on H-1Bs.
So we had an interruption, a cat interruption. So Could you start again and talk about the interviews that you have attempted to make with actual H-1B workers in the United States?
Most of the H-1B individuals that I've interviewed here in the U.S. or attempted to do interviews with are people who work for larger companies like Cisco, Intel, Dell, etc. They don't talk much about abuses, either because these abuses are not happening or because these individuals are reluctant to talk about, to go in that direction. And these individuals who might work for Cisco, Dell, Intel, etc. What happens is when a body shop owner brings H-1Bs from India, they tend to have 3, 4, 5 guys in one single apartment. It's not as if, and many of these are guys, it's not as if these guys have amazing social lives, because all they do is work for these different, get shipped around to different parts of the U.S., work for these companies, and come back home.
I'm sorry.
It's been very difficult. Shall I start? Okay. It's been very difficult to actually interview individuals who work for body shops, people who might be on H-1Bs, and there's a reason for that. The reason being that issues of access are really, really, it's issues of access. Many of these individuals who work for body shops are guys, and they tend to be men that are hired from India. And many of these guys live in small little apartments, perhaps that are designed for one individual, but you might have 4 or 5 guys living in these apartments that the company has rented for them. And it's not as if these guys have great social lives. All they do is go to the various companies that they're contracted out to in various parts of the U.S., finish their projects, and come back to these apartments. So it's very difficult to meet these individuals to actually start doing your interviews. So it's been very hard to actually interview these individuals. Individuals have not been able to even access them. But those other individuals who I have interviewed and have not talked about being abused through an H-1B system, they might not talk about abuse either because abuse is not happening or because they might worry about the repercussions that they might face at the workplace if they do start complaining about about their H-1B status and how they're being abused.
We've got another thought here.
Well, what I wanted to emphasize is that the H-1B visa process is completely voluntary. No one is holding a gun to these people's heads saying apply for these jobs. They're completely voluntary. But just because it's voluntary doesn't mean it cannot be abusive. It's
history. So could you talk about, is that a new thing, or could you talk about?
Well, religion starts taking on a very different kind of significance for Indians living in the U.S. For example, you might never go as often to temples, or you might not attend religious chanting and singing sessions, which we call bhajan sessions where you sing. We might not attend those in India. But once we immigrate into the U.S., temples and these sorts of religious occasions start taking on a new significance. It doesn't mean that these people are finding God because they've arrived into the U.S. On the contrary, they're finding each other. So it is about life on this world that is really more important to them than an afterlife.
Satellite television from India.
Getting, you know, people have access to satellite television from India. There's also all kinds of DVDs that are coming over from India. And sometimes certain films might have simultaneous releases in India and certain theaters in the U.S. For example, Austin has a theater which shows Indian films once a week. So these are other places. Popular culture, you know, is such a space that ties Indian immigrants together. So if you go to